This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with the Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, this is a thrill for me today because I get to talk about one of my favorite subjects, Napoleon. Oh, I have been crazy about Napoleon since I was a kid, and I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper Allison Pataki and Owen Pataki, and they've written a wonderful book called Where the Light Falls. And this one is set in the Revolutionary period. And, you know, I have to tell everyone, I've talked many times about my honeymoon, my first honeymoon, when my husband and I did Italy from top to bottom. We went all the way from the very tippy top of Italy down to the boot, the end of the line, and from there we took a ferry over to Greece. But our second honeymoon was spent in Waterloo because my husband knew me very well and he knew what would make me happy. So I am happy to welcome you guys to the program. Wow, Owen, are you there?
I'm here. Good morning, Patsy.
Did Allison make it?
Hi. Yes, good morning.
Okay. Well, the two of you. Whoa. You know, I had such a wonderful weekend. When I got these two books, I just set everything else aside. Because, as I said, I love Napoleon, and I had just this weekend of remembering all of the places that I went to. My husband was really wonderful. We went to all the battlefields. We just drove all around France, and so it was just a fantastic, fantastic honeymoon. And I just want you to tell everyone about this fantastic book you've written.
Well, thank you. Those definitely sound like two very nice honeymoons. I can describe a little bit about the process from my end, and I think maybe Allie can add on to some of her experience coming up, you know, with ideas with me with the book. But really, this came about a long, long time ago. I was actually in high school, and I was studying. I took a course on revolution, on the Iranian Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and the French Revolution. And in that class, you know, we learned about the Reign of Terror and Robespierre and all the kind of interesting, you know, big highlights of the French Revolution. And in that class, we watched a movie called Danton, starring Gerard Depardieu, who's a famous French actor. The movie was out, I think, in the 80s sometime. And that really just kind of sparked in me this kind of fascination with the time period. Like you said, with Napoleon, you know, that's very interesting. The Reign of Terror, you know, the French Revolution as compared to the American Revolution, and how in a lot of ways they're so similar, but in other ways they're so very different. So I had this idea back in high school, and our you know, we have French heritage in our family, so the seed was planted at a very young age. But I had this idea, and the characters kind of came to me as I kind of did a little more research on the French Revolution, and I kind of had a basic skeleton of a plot of the story that would become Where the Light Falls, and I wanted to make it into a movie or a series or something, but I didn't. At the time, I was kind of busy doing other things, and I took the idea to Allie, and Allie really encouraged it and really kind of ran with it. And Allie, I'll let you kind of jump in there.
Yeah, absolutely. So Owen and I are both history dorks like you, Patsy. It sounds like we are in good company. And really, our whole family is we love reading, we love stories, but we also really just love stories that are based in history, because we think that history provides just the absolute best raw material. And so and particularly, we're probably similar to you in this, it sounds like, as well, as we're Francophiles. We love French history. We have a very deep connection to France just because we have a lot of family over there. Our grandmother, Monique LeBlanc, was 100% French. She was a French war bride during World War II. And as a result, we have aunts and uncles and cousins and second cousins who still live in Paris and elsewhere throughout France. So when Owen came to me with the seeds of this story, just knowing our shared passion for Napoleonic history, knowing our shared passion for all things France, and knowing our shared passion for all things great storytelling, I said, hey, Owen, why don't we do this together as a book? You know, Owen was seeing it in his mind with a very visual sort of cinematic quality, and I was seeing it in my mind as a novelist already at that point who had written several books as a story. And so I said, why don't we do both? And why don't we start and write this book together? And so that's where we started years ago. And the finished product is what you were kind enough to read for us.
Well, it's so fascinating. And what I love about it, you've developed these characters, the main characters, which I will have you explain. And they are so well developed. They are so, I mean, I started to, well, I did. I still do. I believe in them. I believe that they're real. And I mean, I also, like Owen, I can see them on the screen. When I love a book, I always see it as a film. And so I think that was part of why I had this fantastic weekend. Because, you know, there is nothing to watch on television right now. It's just horrible. And I didn't need anything. It was all in my head. I had like 2 days of walking around in a film because of both books, you know, because not this book. And then, of course, I also read the other book, Searches in Winter. And so combining those two books in my head, I had the most wonderful weekend.
Well, thank you so much. That's very nice of you to say. And hopefully someday we might be able to see it on television. That's kind of the dream for me, to see it someday realize into some visual format, some medium. But that's very kind of you to say. And like Ali said, this was always kind of, at least from the beginning, an idea that would be on a visual medium. But Ali, like she mentioned, she had 3 New York Times bestsellers at that point when I kind of unofficially pitched the idea, or at least presented to her. So she had the experience, as she mentioned, with the literary background. And it was a good chance for me to kind of take a chance into something. I never really kind of stumbled into writing these books. I never really planned it. It wasn't really the original idea. But it, with Allie's help, she absolutely jumped on board, dove in head first, and it was a very, very productive and very good partnership for me, at least.
Well, like any compelling book, you have to come out with good characters. So tell us about this young, enthusiastic, idealistic lawyer, about him, about his wife, and how you built the story around them.
Yeah, I think, and Ali can jump in with this as well, but I think Andre and Jean-Luc, for me, this may not have been intentional. It's hard to really describe the process of how you build a character. You know, there's no one answer, but I think, to me, both of those characters kind of exist in the same universe, so to speak, in that they bring two different aspects of kind of, you know, the more, let's say, enlightened or, you know, justice-conscious figures in a time that's very, very bloodthirsty, very obviously ambitious with Napoleon and the French revolutionaries and the Jacobins and all these characters. It was a very, very Joseph Fouché, who's a character in the second book. It's a pretty Machiavellian time, and we were just kind of wondering what would happen to these people who weren't starting out bloodthirsty. You know, they weren't radicals to begin with. They did have a little bit more of a kind of ethical or moral code. They aren't completely, you know, willing to use violence and kind of go into that kind of darker side of human nature. So I think Jean-Luc and Andre kind of came out as Andre being sort of the man of action, the army officer, the former nobility, and Jean-Luc is more of the cerebral, intellectual lawman, like lawyer. And they both kind of occupy similar roles in different spaces in a very tumultuous time that was very, you know, the law was very important, obviously, with the revolutionary tribunals and you know, the courts with King Louis and Marie Antoinette being sent to the guillotine. The lawmen really came to the fore in creating this new republic, just like America, with, you know, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, but also you have the military aspects to it. And Andre is that rare kind of former aristocrat member of the nobility who embraces the spirit, at least, of the revolution, and he will pay respect for that. But that did happen. There were plenty of nobles who kind of saw the more enlightened aspects of the revolution and were on board with it. But any more than that, Ali, I'll let you dive into your end of things.
Yeah, we found it to be so particularly interesting because the French Revolution in so many ways started out so hopeful for the common people, like Jean-Luc and like an André. And in a lot of ways, you know, they were emulating and there were parallels, obviously, to the American Revolution. But then, ultimately, we see within just a few years that the French, who were our allies and champions for liberty, for our own American Revolution, they take this very, very dark turn. And they become sort of this really dark, you know, funhouse mirror image of our revolution and sort of the darkest side of humanity and the darkest side of what our revolution could have become if you know, the better angels of liberty and of the founding fathers and the common man and woman had taken a turn for, you know, sort of the darker demons of human nature. And so we wanted to see how the common people on the street, we wanted to sort of explore how you navigate that and what that means for the citizens. And then Sophie, obviously, we knew we wanted to round out this trio with strong female characters. And that's where Sophie comes in. That's where Marie comes in. You know, in any period of great tumult, which the French Revolution was obviously one of the most tumultuous periods in modern Western European history, you know, there's loss, there's fighting, there's, as Owen said, there's the law, there's anarchy, and there's love, and there's love stories. So we also wanted to include that and have love stories in this as well. And so we just, these characters just began to form for us in our minds, and their stories overlap, their stories at times, you know, intersect and sometimes go in different directions. But then Owen really saw these characters through, and that's where he, you know, we ended where the light falls, and Owen really felt like there was more story for these characters. And so they evolved and they grew, and we just really became very attached to exploring these years and these moments of tumult through their eyes.
Well, that happens when characters take over. It's like me and I, for me, they're real people. And with a writer, of course, when they start taking over your head, you know, they're real.
They take on their own lives and their own thoughts and their own agency.
Well, so many people don't, well, of course, first of all, most Americans don't know any history, but particularly they don't know about the French Revolution. They don't know the details of it. And it's where it turned into this terror, where it turned into this horrid, horrible thing, where people, they were just killing people for no reason. Explain that a little bit. How did that happen? No, as you know, they started off as exactly, you know, with that idea that they were going to make things better, but boy, somewhere along the line, they took a bad, you know, a bad avenue, and it wasn't the Champs-Élysées. Well, it actually was down, right down to where they, you know, I've walked that area so many times where they had the guillotine, and it's still so hard to believe that from the beginning of hope they went into that.
And it is the end of the Champs-Élysées, actually, where the what it was called, the Place de la Révolution at the time. That's where much of the guillotine beheadings took place. But to your question, where kind of how and why did it go so wrong? It's hard to give any one answer. I think a simple aspect of it would be that in any revolution, there is an element of anger and rage and revolution, the American Revolution being one where, you know, there were tax collectors being tarred and feathered. There was a kind of vicious civil war aspect to our own, you know, where the loyalists, the Tories, the you know, the redcoats, there was a lot of violence in our own revolution and our own civil war. So that comes kind of with the revolutionary territory. Look at the Russian Revolution or the Cuban Revolution or the Iranian. They're all kind of an expression of rage of people who don't feel like they've had a voice. So that you know, that happens in a tumultuous revolutionary time period. But where the French Revolution, I think, and you know, this isn't an official kind of declarative statement, but I think an aspect of why the French Revolution became so I think there's two or three reasons. And one of the big ones was their king was right in their city. You know, he was at Versailles, the king and queen, Marie Antoinette, Louis XVI. They were lightning rods for the revolutionaries. But they were right there. During our revolution, King George III was across the Atlantic, and we couldn't get to him. You know, we were being kind of, you know, tread upon, quote unquote, by the British army, you know, the Redcoats. But we couldn't really reach the motherland at that time of England, London, and the king. So the French were able to get their hands on the king. He tried to escape, and that made them more kind of paranoid and frustrated and you know, angry. And so that, in and of itself, makes it a more kind of dangerous place to be, because you have the royalists who are still loyal to the king, many are aristocrats, many are conservative Catholics, but then you also have the radicals, and they're in the same city, they're in the same countryside, they're neighbors, literally, to each other. I think another two aspects of it, I'll try to get it briefly, is the role of religion and tradition. I think, you know, France was called the eldest daughter of the Catholic Church, of the papacy, and Catholicism and religion and church and going to mass was a very, very important aspect of, you know, medieval French society, and the revolution did away with all of that. The revolution essentially declared God is dead, the republic is now your religion, and that would unfold as the terror gets worse and worse, and a lot of people didn't like that. So you had, there was a quasi-religious aspect to this conflict, and both sides, just the more they disagreed, the more extreme the two sides got, and it really just erupted in violence in the countryside, not just Paris, but, you know, up major cities like Lyon. So you had that aspect of it. And then the third one is if there was a foreign war. You know, the Prussians, the Austrians, the British, the Spanish, the you know, Papal States, they all did war on France at the same time, the Russians. So because the revolution, killing a king, creating a republic, that's a threat to all the other kings and queens across Europe. So there was an element of kind of this, you know, world war. France was at war. So in a wartime, as we know in America, liberties tend to kind of get shoved down. You know, there's less habeas corpus and more, you know, stay loyal. So all of those factors together, I think, contributed to why this would get so violent and so bloodthirsty.
Yeah, and I think you have to take into account, it's hugely important to remember the constituency of who is leading the uprising. So when you have the 13 colonies, you have a population that, just by virtue of the fact that they have chosen to travel across an ocean to set up their own society, to seek greater rights for themselves, to seek greater autonomy for themselves away from the crown, and they are an educated, literate, intrepid, self-selecting population by virtue of the fact that that's where they are. Versus you have France, you have hundreds of years of a crushing ancien regime, you know, old society that is formed with the hierarchy of the nobility and the church taking from the poor to ennoble and enrich their own lives for hundreds of years. So you have a peasantry that is, in America, in the colonies, you have a separate society that's thriving, that is self-selected to work and go it alone. Versus in France, you have this population that has been crushed and suffering and starving for years. And so, as Owen said, like, think about just the anger and sort of the I guess, all of the context of that that's going into their respective revolutions when they declare that they are breaking apart from the king.
Well, you've done a beautiful job in writing the story. And I want to again mention, I really like the female characters and the strength that you put into them, because that really helps to carry the whole story. Because we really, I think particularly Maria, I really was drawn to her. I hope that, you know, more people, I'm trying to get more people to read history, because as you said, you can learn from it. And unfortunately, in many cases, we don't learn at all. If I can, having been very deeply involved in the history of the sort of what happened to the British in Afghanistan, and I'm talking back in the 1800s, I could have predicted what happened today, but people don't learn from history. And it would be really nice if people would start reading more history and really start to think about it. And I would love to have people to start, like they used to have sort of a salon where you have, now we can't get together, but maybe on Zoom, have groups of people actually having conversations about these historical books. And that might be a very good thing for you guys to do, to start a kind of Zoom chat room for this book and about the history of the revolution in France, because we learn a lot about people, about the nature of human beings by studying that period of time. So I hope that you have a lot of opportunities to promote the book.
Thank you.
We hope so too.
Yeah. Likewise, we appreciate this, and I think podcasts are kind of at the forefront of that. I think there are a lot of historical podcasts. I know some of my friends listen to, you know, multiple different podcasts that are history centered. So I think that's very helpful, and we appreciate you having us on to talk about it. And I think Allie would definitely agree with me, I'm sure. You know, historical fiction is a good way to kind of get people curious, you know, people who don't otherwise know about the French Revolution or Napoleon, or who just took a course one time. I think a novel sometimes brings you into that world, and it just kind of opens your eyes and gets the curiosity going.
Well, if I could have people over, you know, if I could open up the doors and have people over and have a croissant party and invite people over to sit around and talk about your books, I would. But meanwhile, I hope that you are, you know, getting to all of these events and really create a salon for yourselves for your books and get noticed, because we need more. Well, we need, I can tell you, having seen what Hollywood is putting out, they need these. They need these two books. It would make a wonderful, wonderful series. Something really intelligent and very cinematic. So I'm hoping that you can find ways to promote the book. It's not easy. It's never easy to promote books, but that you have a lot of opportunity here. And I think if you reach the right people, and one of the nice things, why I always hope that people will get something, some kind of a movie deal, some kind of a television deal, is that then people start reading the books too. So it's sort of a, you know, it's a circular thing. If you get people to, if you get the movie, then people read the book, then you get to write more books. So I hope that your marketing is, you kick it into full gear, and you never know. And maybe you'll be back here to announce that you've got a deal for streaming video. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, do you know anyone?
our doors are open.
Okay, well, I'm trying actually to make connections for several people, because I know, you know, having, as I do, I read so much, I know when I see a book that I want to see on film, I really need to become an influencer, because I know what would make a great film, and this, your two books would be fantastic. And later on, Allison, one day I'll have you on to talk about your other books, because you are a great historical writer.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, absolutely. I would love that. And I think you are right. I think one thing that's been a really positive change in the past few years is just the explosion of opportunities to tell stories on the screen that the storytellers have available now, with so many streamers, with so many cables, with television really working to do such high quality content. It's no longer like,
yeah, you know, you have opportunities here. Now, do you have a website you want people to go to?
Absolutely. So my website is my name, so AllisonPataki.com. So Allison with two L's, A-L-L-I-S-O-N, Pataki, P-A-T-A-K-I.com.
And Owen is...
My name as well, OwenPataki.com. And I guess I would just also, you know, if anybody's interested or enjoyed this conversation, I would just recommend they look for Searchers in Winter or Where the Light Falls on Amazon. They're both available in, you know, Kindle, hardcover, paperback, online, on Amazon.
Okay. Well, thank you both for being on Joy on Paper today. It's been a joy to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Jesse.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Oh, right. What day. I think my next guest is ready, and he is ready, and I am so happy to talk talking to Crispin Boyer again. Hi, Crispin.
Good morning. Hi, Pat.
Okay. Well, how is the King of Ishkalak? And are you having fun in Hawaii?
I'm well, and yeah, always. We have a nice farm here in Hawaii, and we have a new donkey on our farm, and we found out our donkey might be pregnant, so it's never a dull moment.
Wow. You create material for yourself. Oh, this is
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, what are we going to talk about? Again, we talk about Zeus the Mighty. You know, these books are so wonderful, and I have so much fun when I get to talk to people with kids, and I say, what book? What are your kids reading? And I said, they have to read Crispin Boyer because those books are so wonderful. So tell us about the newest one.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, first of all, thanks so much for even promoting my books to your friends and getting the word out there. I love talking to you about them because I think you really get them. The Zeus the Mighty series is about Zeus, a hamster in a pet rescue center who believes that he is king of the Greek god. And in this latest episode, this book three, Zeus has to deal with a new Olympian member at the pet rescue center, which is a hen named Hermes. And, you know, Zeus has got a big ego. He's a little hamster, big ego, big attitude. He's not the sharpest tool in the pet center, to make some metaphors there, but he doesn't want to just let any animal into the Olympians, which is from mythology is a group of Greek gods. There's 12 of them in total, and so this story is about how Hermes the hen earns her place with the Olympians, and they go on an adventure inspired by the myth of Hercules or Heracles, as some Greek historians call him, and in this book it's Harry, please, Harry, like Harry, like a, you know, we love our puns.
Yeah, I love it. I love all the titles. They're always so good.
Well, that's half the battle is coming up with a title. So they go on different adventures, different trials for Hermes to earn her place. So they have to fight a Hydra monster. They have to deal with Cerberus, this three-headed guard dog. I don't want to spoil them all, but like the other books in the series, it tackles a myth. It hides some educational value inside these zany adventures.
Well, it is. They are fantastic. And I think perhaps it's your love of animals that makes you the king of writing about these little creatures. It's so wonderful to read them. And I, of course, love Greek history, Roman history. I was reading in Latin at a very young age, and I really enjoy all of this. But having all of this fun stuff that you do with it, that you take these characters and just, well, you know, when I first read about Zeus, you know, and he's a hamster, I thought to myself, this is so clever. You know, people have for years been thinking about Zeus, and they never thought of him as a hamster. And I thought, I like Crispin Boyer.
Well, this is an idea that was spawned from my editor at National Geographic, and she invited me to take this world and roll with it. And I think, yeah, when you think about it, Zeus, who in the pantheon of Greek gods, and all the Greek gods, they're kind of jerks to each other. They're always playing tricks on each other and doing with actually pretty despicable things to each other. Zeus is this, you know, giant, powerful god. So then, condense him down into a hamster, but maintain that attitude. And of course, in our series, the gods aren't so despicable to each other. It's more about how they work together. The god of war, and then he's Ares, a pug. There's a pufferfish, who is Poseidon. There's Demeter, who is the grasshopper, and that's like the god of the harvest. And so each of these different characters, there's Athena the cat. She's like the goddess of wisdom. Each of these characters kind of distills down the essence of these Greek gods. And then the main thing is that each book takes a different myth from mythology and explains it. And then also there's some educational stuff in the back that, once readers finish the book, they can go and read about the truth behind the fiction and read about the actual myth and the actual gods and life in ancient Greece. And ancient Greece itself is kind of represented in this pet center, and the different parts of the pet center correspond to parts of ancient Greece. So where Zeus lives, he's on the highest shelf in the store, and that's Mount Olympus. There's the aquarium section where Poseidon lives. That's the Aegean Sea and you know, Mediterranean, and it all. If you look at the map of the pet center, which we put at the front of the book, and then if you look at a map of ancient Greece at the back of the book, you kind of see how everything lines up, which is another like fun little twist for readers to figure out.
Well, it is. It's very clever. You obviously are having lots of fun with this. And again, Nat Geo is so fantastic. They come out with these great books for children. You know, particularly now, there were so many kids. I was recommending the books to people during this whole pandemic-y time. I said, you know, you have your kids, and make it an adventure in your own home. You don't need to do anything else except to have some of these books, have Nat Geo books, because I believe in Nat Geo books. I was raised with those Nat Geo yellow magazines. I mean, that was my connection to the outside world. You know, I lived in northern Michigan in the middle of nowhere, and my connection to the outside world was when we got those Nat Geo books, and we treasured those books, those magazines.
I can relate, yeah.
You know, when I was a homeschool mom for many, many years, and I always made, really, homeschooling for my boys was a constant, continuous treasure hunt. If they wanted something, if I wanted them to learn something, I always turned it into some kind of treasure hunt, hiding clues all over the place, outside, inside, so that they would, and maps. I love maps, and I love diagrams. And so this is part of the fun that they can, parents, really take these books and have fun with your kids. And as they grow older, they're familiar with the names. And I think natural curiosity, you want to know the real story. You know, when you get to maybe 16 years old, you say, okay, now let's see, you know, maybe we'll read, you know, something. Maybe actually we take a Latin class again in high school. I don't think they offer them anymore. But, you know, I think your books are so great, because they really can inspire people to, and I think a lot of parents also, they're reading the books and they say, well, yeah, I've heard of that character. You know, I know that. Poseidon, yeah, we saw the movie. Now let's find out what it means, right?
Well, yeah, and I think that's cool, hearing about how you taught your boys with the treasure maps and just really making it, I think making it interactive is the key, like in keeping them engaged. I imagine even like today it'd be even harder with everything competing for a kid's attention. So many different things pulling at the threads of like, you know, what they want to do, whether it's online or YouTube movies or game like iPad games and that kind of thing. And I think at this point, if you can't really beat them, so throw everything you can at it. Like the Zeus books have. They have a podcast that kind of goes along with them called Greeking Out. It's inspired by the book. So, you know, that's part of our philosophy with the book. So there's a website, ZeusTheMighty.com, where readers can go and they could play interactive games and learn a lot more about the characters. They could listen to the podcast or they could read the books. So it's like you said, just and we have maps in the books also.
Yeah, I love maps. I love any book with a map in it. I go crazy. It's just... It's something so exciting for me. When I was a kid, there was a map. It would lead you out. It would lead you out into the world, and that's what was exciting. When did you, you know, realize how actually deeply talented you are in writing books like this? This is coming from some you know, real depth of understanding, I think, of sort of animals and people, and you put a lot into these books.
Well, yeah, I mean, this Zeus is a fiction series, which is a new kind of writing for me. I've written, and I've been on your show to talk about other books that were nonfiction for National Geographic, where I'd write about things like spies and history and things like that. And I've written about that kind of stuff for National Geographic for a long time, for almost 20 years. this point, and I've got, you know, dozens of books about that. And then they approached me and said they were starting to do fiction series, and specifically Zeus the Mighty, and asked if I was interested, and I was definitely interested because I grew up loving reading fiction, but I'd never really written it. And so I was hoping that my skills would translate. I think I have a knack for explaining complicated topics in a fun way in these other books that I've been doing for them about, you know, like there's just to talk about castles or ninjas and or things like that. And so now it's a matter of building, taking that same approach, that same colorful language, and building and taking my own experience reading fiction growing up, reading everything, science fiction, Stephen King. I would always have a book when I was a kid. And then figuring out how to tell a story, and fortunately they have really good editors, National Geographic, and they hooked me up with a really good fiction editor who, you know, the first book, I'd say, went through about 10 revisions. The first book was the Quest for the Golden Fleas, and that was me just figuring out, like, when you're writing a story, originally I had too many characters and too much going on. It was too complicated, and my editor, you know, explained, you're losing the plot here. You're going off into the weeds. So she really helped me hone in what it means to tell a good story, you know, that's punchy and gets to the point and it's easy to follow. And now I'm actually just finished book five, because, you know, we have to work pretty far ahead because the books are illustrated and there's a lot that goes into them, a lot of editing and revising. I feel like for me, this series has been just a blast just to grow with it. And like you said, I love animals. And in fact, the hen Hermes that's in this series is based on one of our chickens here on the farm. So in some ways, life is imitating art and vice versa.
Well, no, I realized that when I was reading that, I said, this guy, originally I thought, this guy has a good relationship with animals because you have to sort of have that in order to get into their heads, and you have certainly done that. And also, this book was illustrated by Andy Elkerton, did a great job.
Oh, yeah, he always does a great job. In fact, you know, the process is somewhat collaborative because we'll meet on a regular basis. We work through the revisions, and he'll show the illustrations he's working on. And sometimes I'll look at these illustrations, and I'll be like, wow, you've come up with something that's actually better than what I wrote. So then I'll go back and revise what I wrote a bit to match his illustration. So it really does help me as a writer too, because, you know, I envision these scenarios and things in my head, you know, in the books when the Olympians are fighting a big sea monster, and, you know, in the pet center, it's actually an overflowing toilet. So it's a lot to illustrate. Imagine if you have to illustrate a bunch of animals, a cat, a hamster, a fish, who's in a dive helmet so he can have air, and then they're battling a sea monster that's actually a toilet, and he's got quite a challenge.
Well, he does, and he's very clever, really, really great. I love all of them. It's just, I wish actually I had these when my kids were little, but one of the things I really want to tell people, this is so much fun. The books are so much fun, and as I said, they come from a deep understanding of the subject. I don't think you could write so well if you didn't know all of these facts. Sort of when we talk about having sort of things at your fingertips, I feel that way, that this was really done with a great deal of a depth that one doesn't perhaps always get in books like these. And I think that's why they really work so well. And Nat Geo pick the right person to do it, because you do it so, so very well.
Oh, well, thank you very much. That means a lot. And, you know, we have a Greek history expert who does vet them. Her name's Diane Klein. So she also helps me keep add as much of the rich detail from the history period, that insanely interesting period in history. there's no end of source material. But, you know, we also don't want to go too far off and off the guardrails and have the stories just be, like, completely coming out of my head. So there has to be some basis in the actual fact within this fiction. But she does a great job. She'll read through the outlines and suggest characters and plot twists, and then she'll read through the manuscript revisions and tell me whether this isn't this doesn't have any basis in the mythology, or this is actually a nice, you know, twist on a myth, or this character would be great if it was based on this particular character. Because there's so many different, the thing about the Greek gods, there's so many strange relationships of parents and daughters and brothers and sisters and how they're all related together, and it would be way too complicated and actually not all that appropriate.
No, exactly. We don't want to explain too much. But yeah. later on when they get old enough and they're familiar with the names, and perhaps I don't know what they're teaching in school anymore, but as I said, one of the things that, for example, studying Latin, I always found in school really focused your mind. So I hope there was a school in Houston where when I lived there, and it was a private school, and he started all the children like in England, all of the young kids started Latin at like 6 and 7, and you know, just ordinary kids from an ordinary neighborhood. And of course, he ran out of money. He didn't have any support, but he was really, he tried for, like, I think he lasted maybe 5 years, but he taught them, like, you know, if the English boys in their school can, of course, it was boys in Eton and all of those, they could learn Latin at, you know, as children. Every kid can learn another language as a child. It's up to, you know, the parents if they want people to learn. But I like the way that you've written these books, and I think perhaps parents will say, yeah, you know, we can tackle bigger subjects too. We can understand a little bit about history, and I just love these books. Really, I get so thrilled, and I hope that are you doing like Zoom events with kids too, or do you get to have sort of connections?
Yeah, I've done that. I've gone into, you know, virtual classrooms and sat down and read some of the book and fielded questions. And yeah, no, it's one of my favorite parts is to interact with the readers and hear what they think about the books, and also, of course, hear their questions. And inevitably, you know, they learn that I'm on a farm, so then the questions go about to the animals and how they're related to the animals in the book. And it's a blast.
Well, one would not one thinks of people moving to Hawaii, we don't think of them moving there to live on a farm. But I think that's cool. I think that's so wonderful.
Oh, thanks. It's a great place to live on a farm because it's pretty much consistent weather all year round. Maybe a little rainy sometimes, but yeah.
Well, I think it's wonderful. And one of the things I want to say to people, you know, if you really get these books, and if for your own children or for the children in your family, if you don't have any children in your family, get these books and send them to a children's hospital. There's always a children's hospital in your neighborhood, you know, in your town, or you can send it to St. Jude's or one of the other children's hospitals, because the children who are in hospitals need these books. They really need books. And so if you're going to do something wonderful, if you want to give a real treat to a child, just call up one of the hospitals and say, you know, where can I send these books? And just order it online. You can go to Amazon and Barnes & Noble and just, or Nat Geo. You can go straight to Nat Geo Kids, I'm sure, and just order them and have them sent directly to a hospital. And just imagine how thrilled a kid in a hospital would be to get these books. It will put a smile on their faces that you will not believe. I think it's just so fantastic what you've done with these books. So I hope that people will think about that.
No, I think that's a great idea, and they are like super. They are a nice book just to get out of the as a present because they're very colorful. they grab your attention. And the illustrations, they're very heavily illustrated. So there's and like you said, you know, and as we're getting through the pandemic, they're a nice way to still get out and explore the world from wherever you are.
Exactly, and as I've said over and over to people, you don't have to have a kid in order to make a kid happy. You can just send these books, and it will thrill the kids. And I have been talking to Nat Geo people for years now. I have said that one of the things they have to do is make Thanksgiving Day a Nat Geo gift day, because whenever you have Thanksgiving, and hopefully people again will be able to get together this year, instead of bringing wine or flowers, because all people already have the wine and the flowers for Thanksgiving, bring a Nat Geo book. And if you're going to a house where there are kids, bring them the whole, well, how many books do we now have in the Zeus, the Mighty Books, and just, you know, this is a kind of gift that will last a lifetime. People won't give these books away. It's like, I still have those yellow magazines from years ago. You can't throw them away. You can't, you know, they're precious.
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah, and just they're endlessly readable. You can go back to them, and I would love the idea of having Nat Geo give book giveaway on Thanksgiving, give different books, and you know, a lot of these books, like the Zeus series, book three, but you know, there are other fact-based books are really, you can just sit there and open them to any page and find some interesting fact or some cool illustration, or you could sit down and read them, you know, sequentially. And even my Zeus series, when we laid out the plan for the books, we wanted it to be that a reader could really pick any of the books that the cover looked cool, grabbed their interest. So you don't have to necessarily read them from the beginning, although you'll pick up a few extra things. So there may just be very readable, and just even for reluctant readers to grab their attention and get them reading.
Exactly. Okay. Well, Crispin Boyer, again, where, say the website so everybody knows where to go.
ZeusTheMighty.com.
Simple and easy to go to, ZeusTheMighty.com, and read, get these books. And again, Crispin, thank you so much. It's early over there in Hawaii, right? A little bit
early.
A little.
I get up with the chickens, so it's fine.
Okay. I know the feeling. I used to get up with the chickens, too. And I love them. And I did know them very well. And I can see why you would base a character on one of your favorites. Anyway,
yeah.
Crispin, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thanks, as always, for having me, and looking forward to being on again.
Okay. Keep writing. You'll be here. Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Oh, he's so nice. He's so nice. I like him so much. The King of Ishkalak. That was the place where he used to live. And he's going to... I just like him. Oh, it's funny. The other day, I was talking to someone, and the Joubert's, suddenly the line went dead. I didn't realize they were in Botswana. They were calling me from Botswana. I think that was definitely my first call from Botswana. But they sent me a nice message saying, sorry, we got cut off at the end there because, you know, we are in Botswana. And I didn't know that. I didn't know where they were at the time. But they were so sweet, and they sent me a nice, nice email saying they were sorry they didn't get to say goodbye because they loved being on Joy on Paper. And their book, of course, is The Ultimate Guide to African Animals. A wonderful book. Again, another wonderful book that, you know, if you know a child, get this book because the kids will love it and parents will love it because you can just spend hours. And it is really the ultimate guide. There are so many stories in there and about their adventures. And they've been doing this for 30 years and writing about the animals in Africa. And it's really, really fantastic. So definitely, that's another one of these books that you should get. And if you don't have a kid in your family, although you don't need a kid, actually, this book is for adults. I know it's they market it for kids. But if you like Africa, you'll love this book. And also, again, a great gift to send to a children's hospital. And speaking of that, I just want to say again, I didn't have time to play another book buzz from Devon Miller, but I am so very, very proud of him. And he's just doing such a wonderful job in doing these book buzzes for books for children, because he spent time when he was a child in a hospital. And so he knows what it's like to be in a hospital and to need books. And of course, he was inspired to start writing himself. And he wrote the series Mr. Tickety Talk Clock. And I just want to, again, thank him so much for doing that. We also, I wanted to thank somebody else. I don't remember now why my mind is going. It has been a heck of a week. I've had a really exciting time here. you know, it's sort of just thrilling just thinking about talking to Botswana, and the last month I talked to Czechoslovakia. Well, it's not Czechoslovakia anymore. It's the Republic of Czech, whatever they call it now. They changed the name of these countries. But it was wonderful to talk to somebody in Czechoslovakia. And I'm going to talk to somebody in Poland in a month or so. And that's always exciting. Wow, isn't it wonderful what we can do nowadays with all these wonderful connections? So I'm having fun. Originally, when I started this program, I thought I'd be talking to local authors. As a matter of fact, I didn't know I would be going out around the world, but it is really exciting. And I want to thank those of you who send, and particularly, and I'm going to mention somebody from the Ukraine who writes me all the time. I mean, he listens to every program, and I want to thank him so much because I love getting, emails from around the world. And of course, it's really exciting. I also want to say something. I've been thinking so much about the authors who have been on this program, and I want to thank each and every one of them. I could do one of those shows where I read every name and said, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. But particularly, I want to thank Rita Moreau also, because she does the book buzzes. And all of these things that we do for authors, that we try to promote their books long after the books have been released. And this doesn't happen very often. Mostly, a book is released and nobody ever talks about it again. But we try to keep talking about books so that you are reminded of the books that you should read. And that, I want to thank Bill Larson of Larson & Larson, and of course Glenn Erickson for sponsoring Joy on Paper. Bill Larson is a great intellectual property lawyer. He's my lawyer, and I can tell you there are times when you're going to really be happy if you've actually done things with a lawyer, because you never know. You never know what's out there and when something will happen. You have a book, and perhaps it, was a fairly good seller and, didn't sell a lot. And then something happens, and maybe you're writing it about a specific subject, and suddenly it's hot and you get a movie deal, but you haven't protected yourself. So you have to think about it. So contact Bill Larson at Larson & Larson and protect your intellectual property. And just remember what I always tell everyone. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I'm hoping for Carol J. Perry and her Witch City Mysteries. And she's going to be here at the end of the month to talk about her new series. Wow, this is exciting. My goodness. And say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room, because I am running out of time, everybody. And he saluted me, and I saluted him, and I should have been a general, because I would have been a great general, and I believe I would have been better than a lot of generals that I'm thinking about today. Bye-bye now.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
WZHR Zephyr Hills
FM 104.3
Listen.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Rocket Mortgage.
I'm Steve Kathan. The Pentagon says it's pushing ahead with the effort to get Americans and others out of Afghanistan. CBS's Cammie McCormick.
The U.S. military has evacuated 7,000 people so far, and with more planes coming in and more gates secured.
We intend to maximize each plane's capacity. We're prioritizing people above all else.
More than 5,000 American troops are at the airport now, and Major General Hank Taylor says they're aware of the risks involved.
F-18s from the Ronald Reagan Carrier Strike Group flew armed overwatch flights over Kabul to ensure enhanced security.
They're among the air assets that were being used to guarantee a safe U.S. withdrawal of forces.
There have been some protests against the Taliban regime today in several parts of the country. Here at home, police activity in Washington, D.C., an investigation into a pickup truck with a possible explosive device outside the Library of Congress. WTOP Radio's Mitchell Miller.
The FBI now involved in this investigation as they try to determine exactly what this threat is. There are reports from the Associated Press that snipers have been brought in. So a lot of activity right now.
The Congress is not in session. Some buildings nearby have been evacuated as a precaution. COVID hotspot Florida is opening a new antibody therapy treatment site in Palm Beach to help treat virus patients. Governor Ron DeSantis.
Since the emergency use authorization for the Regeneron was given at the end of 2020, health systems have been using this all across the state. Results have been very positive.
Now to Northern California. Thousands who've been forced out of their homes by wildfires can only wait and hope. Derek Shaves says his home in the town of Grizzly Flats is gone, and so are many others.
It was a beautiful, close, small, vibrant community. It's nothing now.
Amazon's online dominance doomed many brick-and-mortar retailers. Now, as CBS's Linda Kenyon tells us, the company is drawing up plans and considering square footage.
The Wall Street Journal reports the online giant plans to open several large physical retail locations, similar to department stores, but with a smaller footprint, about one-third the size. Some of these first Amazon department stores are expected in Ohio and California. It's not clear what brands these new retail locations will sell, and the journal points out that the plans are still fluid.
Facebook is launching what it calls work rooms, allowing remote collaboration for people using virtual reality gear. Wall Street right now, a bit of a turnaround. The Dow is up about 2 points. The NASDAQ is ahead 77 points. S&P 500 up 18. This is CBS News.
Presented by Rocket Mortgage. Whether you're looking to purchase a new home or refinance yours, Rocket Mortgage can help you get there. For home loan solutions that fit your life, Rocket can.
Did you ever think about hosting your very own radio show? Here's how.
Hey, Tampa Bay, did you know you can have a one-hour program on the Tantalk Radio Network for less than the cost of one 60-second announcement on many Tampa Bay stations? That's right. We'll put you on the radio for less than the cost of one 60-second announcement on many stations. Check it out today. Use your program to promote yourself, your business, or someone else's business. Call Lola Jean, the broadcast queen, 727-510-7622. That's 510-7622. Call Lola Jean now to check out your Tantalk network program. In addition to network radio, we'll stream your program in audio and video all over the world. Call Lola Jean now, 727-510-7622. Call today. Your network one-hour program can start tomorrow. Broadcast your message in audio and video on the Tantalk Radio Network.
Wednesday, the Rays were looking to continue their great run against the Orioles. After falling behind early, Tampa Bay went ahead for good on this swing.
The Greg Clemente enters a swing and a base hit to left field for Lau to give the Rays the lead. In to score is Wendell, and Brandon Lau delivers. It's 3-2 Rays in the fourth. It's their first lead of the night.
And the way things have been going for the Rays offensively, they certainly weren't done there.
And Valdez throws. Slice down the left field line, heading towards the pole, and lands. Fair ball. Takes a bounce off the pole. And stays in play. It should be an automatic double. Meadows to second with an RBI, and Wander have to go back to third, and the Rays have an 8-4 lead in the eighth.
That turned out to be the final. Every Rays starter had at least one hit. Tampa Bay wins its third straight and will look to sweep the series against the Orioles on Thursday. Shane McClanahan starts airtime at 12:30. With a Rays report, I'm Neil Solons.
For information on the Rays, visit RaysBaseball.com.
Hi, this is Paul Molloy, inviting you to join me every Monday, Tuesday, and Friday for Freedom Works, the Paul Molloy Show, 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time here on the Tantalk Radio Network. On each show, we interview business and political experts, all with the idea of promoting as much individual freedom as we can get. So won't you join and listen in every Monday, Tuesday, and Friday, 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time for Freedom Works, the Paul Molloy Show, right here on the Tantalk Radio Network.
Talking Sports and Knockout Radio is one of, if not the longest running sports radio show in Tampa Bay, and heard every Wednesday from 2 to 4 p.m. right here on the Tantalk Radio Network. From football to MMA and pizza to travel, we talk it all. Every Wednesday from 2 to 4 p.m., we walk the walk and talk the talk. If you have a story you'd like us to cover, just go to knockoutradio.com and click the contact link and send us a suggestion. That's knockoutradio.com/talkingsports.
Go yard is a metaphor used in baseball, meaning to hit a home run. Life struggles can make you feel like you just struck out. It's times like these that we need a little batting practice to pick ourselves back up and get back in the game. Whether you are dealing with marital issues, drug addiction, rebellious teens, anxiety, depression, or just generally having a bad day, call Mama Mac. If life has you down 0-2, before you strike out, learn to go yard. Go yard with Mama Mac on this radio station, Thursdays, 6 o'clock.
Are you looking for a job? Join me, Gene Hodge, on the Employment Opportunity Hour, Thursdays from 7 to 8 p.m., where I will tell you and share with you, as well as answer all of your questions and help you find enjoyable employment instead of a job. This is the only talk show that talks about everyone who makes up our workforce. Join me on the Employment Opportunity Hour every Thursday from 7 to 8 p.m. on the Employment Opportunity Hour.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Welcome to Moments of Clarity with Tiffany Werner, licensed mental health counselor in the state of Florida. Moments of Clarity's mission is to educate and end the stigma on mental health through the inspirational stories of our exceptional guests. You can join in the show by calling Tiffany toll-free at 866-826-1340. Or on Facebook and Twitter at MOC with